Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Welcome to the show. I'm Brian Bellow, and I'm here with my friends Peter Onuf.
Hey, Brian.
And Ed Ayers.
Hello, Brian.
Stay my blade from the flesh of the innocent. Hide in plain sight. Never compromise the Assassin Brotherhood. These are the tenets of the creed.
What creed, you ask? Why, the Assassin's Creed. What's that, you ask? You're not familiar with the Assassin's Creed? Well, allow us to fill you in.
Assassin's Creed is not, as you may be thinking, a movie or a TV show. It's a video game series, the latest installments of which were released last fall. And that voice you heard a moment ago belongs to Shay Patrick Cormack, the character who gamers play as in one of these new games, Assassin's Creed Rogue. Shay is a member of a secret society called the Assassins, but in the game, he goes rogue and joins up with the Assassins' sworn enemies, another secret brotherhood called the Templars. Now, we'll just point out here that this is a fictional storyline, but it unfolds alongside a very real event in American history.
The Seven Years' War was about to begin. I could not have imagined what the future had in store for me.
The Seven Years' War, in case you need a refresher, was fought by Europe's great powers in the 1750s and 60s. I'm guessing it lasted 7 years. The conflict played out in North America as the French and Indian War. I'm a professional historian, and I'm the first to admit that I can never remember who was fighting who in all of those colonial-era wars. So I couldn't help wondering, what do video game designers know about the very complicated geopolitics of the colonial era? Well, that's where this guy comes in.
Hi, my name is Maxime Durand. I'm a historian on the Assassin's Creed series. So basically what I do is I help the team with the historical research.
About 5 years ago, Max Durand was finishing his history degree at the University of Montreal. He wasn't interested in graduate school, but was eager to find a practical outlet for his studies. That's when he saw a job posting for a historical consultant at Ubisoft, the company behind Assassin's Creed.
I don't see any historian that wouldn't like to do this job. It's the power is tremendous because you have hundreds of people working on creating these cities, these scenarios, these characters, these gameplay mechanics, all of these crowds from the past. For me, it's a dream job on a daily basis.
Durand works with developers from story conception to a game's release. He puts together timelines, researches historical figures, and combs through primary sources to make sure the visual components of the game, from weaponry to buildings, are true to the time period. But he also has some input on the less realistic aspects of the game.
In university, you try to look for answers in areas where there are gray zones, where there's an emptiness. And in video games, we actually look for what's already written in history. And we also fill the gaps where there's an empty space, where we put the fiction.
You need to know enough about the real history, in other words, to know how much you can make up.
There are times, says Durand, when game developers have to, well, let's just say make a few compromises. To take one example, in the 1750s and 60s, the city of Philadelphia was an important staging ground for the French and Indian War. Since the game is all about navigating through the war's most important strategic cities, you'd expect Philadelphia to show up in the game. But it doesn't. And Durand says that from the perspective of a gamer who's after the most exciting experience possible, there's a good reason why it doesn't.
Let's say if a city like Philadelphia was interesting in matter of history, as a matter of gameplay, it was less interesting because it was a grid. So we decided to leave it on the side.
All of which raises the age-old question. When it comes to history-themed popular media, is it more important to get the history right or to make something that people will actually like? Duran says it's not an either-or proposition.
I think we can help with learning history in at least one way. Getting to know these characters, these places of the past that are very abstract for many people. And I think it can help into creating curiosity. So I know it's not everyone that's going to study history in university. And I think that's a very good thing also, because I'd have a hard time with the competition for my job. But basically, I mean, everyone is curious, but it's always the way to approach a subject that makes it interesting or not.
For the rest of the hour today, we're going to be tackling this question. What matters most in portrayals of the past? Historical accuracy, or the ability to spur curiosity or raise an interest in the past among as many people as possible? The grist for our discussions will be popular media from 2014. It's our annual It's Time for the Oscars show. But whereas we've limited our discussion to film in the last 2 years, this year we're extending it to media of all sorts.
We'll hear what one former counterintelligence officer has to say about The Americans. That's a TV show about a couple of Cold War-era Soviet spies. We'll consider why history books by journalists sell so much better than history books by historians. And we'll reflect on a surprisingly popular depiction of history in a medium very close to home, podcasts.
But first, we're going to spend a little time considering the controversial portrayal of history in this year's Oscar-nominated film, Selma. The movie was directed by Ava DuVernay and focuses on the 1965 voting rights campaign in Alabama led by Martin Luther King. Now, a lot of scholars and former government officials have criticized the movie for its portrayal of President Lyndon Johnson. He comes across in the film as a stubborn obstacle to King's plans for a march from Selma to Montgomery. The critics point out that Johnson actively supported the campaign for voting rights, and that by 1965, he already had lawyers in his administration drafting a voting rights bill.
DuVernay has defended the movie's portrayal of Johnson, saying, and I'm quoting, "I wasn't interested in making a white savior movie. I was interested in making a movie centered on the people of Selma. What's important for me as a student of this time in history is not to deify what the president did." In a January piece for Slate magazine, Jamel Bowie rallied to DuVernay's defense, saying criticisms of Selma's historical accuracy missed the point. So we invited him to tell us how he thinks the Selma conversation should have played out.
My general view on movies about history, as opposed to sort of documentaries, is that we need to ask questions more about what the filmmaker is trying to do, and less about how accurate is the history. Now, those two are not unrelated, and it's certainly true that extremely inaccurate history can make a movie bad, in part because it muddles the message and sort of takes away from the message of the movie. But for Selma, which is a film where, as far as historical inaccuracies go, it's actually pretty mild. I'd say that the question you need to ask is who is DuVernay trying to emphasize? What is DuVernay trying to emphasize? And I think what she's trying to emphasize are the people who made up the movement, who constituted the movement, and who surrounded King. And in that context, then it actually makes a lot of sense why you would make Johnson a bit more of a roadblock than he was, because by making him a roadblock, you're emphasizing the maneuvering of the people, of King and the people he was leading.
Right. Jamel, I hear you suggesting that there's a kind of trade-off here, that we can tolerate a degree of, well, inaccuracy or more generously, let's say a reductive characterization of the relationships between the two men, because the real history that matters, you're suggesting, has to do with what's going on in Selma itself. Why the double standard, though? Why not do your best to capture in an authentic way, and to use your word, a documentary would, what was going on in the White House, particularly since we have tapes and there is a lot of documentation?
This is one of those questions I think that gets at someone's philosophy of viewing film. I'm not entirely sure that should be the aim of any director. I think the most recent movie to come under these kind of criticisms, besides Selma, was Zero Dark Thirty in 2012. And there was a lot of conversation, a lot of argument about Zero Dark Thirty's depiction of torture. And the argument against the movie was that, listen, this movie shows the use of torture as instrumental to helping the CIA find bin Laden, and that factual statement, you cannot back that up by the evidence, and it is, in fact, really harmful. And I think that the proper response to that criticism, and likewise the proper response to questions about why couldn't Selma just give this documentary perspective on what was happening in the White House, is that films are messages.
Mm-hmm.
And films are crafted towards particular aims. I think Zero Dark Thirty was more movie about sort of what a country does to achieve its safety and what the costs of that are. I think Selma is a movie about what it's like to be in a movement and the struggles right. and the pain that comes with that.
Jamel, let me pick up on your word message. That is that the director had a particular vision or perspective that she wanted to render, and she thinks it's important for it to be out there in the so-called public square. Is that what history does generally, or do you think film has a special license to be message-driven as opposed to one of the boring historical monographs that we write?
I don't think those monographs are very boring at all, but I will say that I do think film has that license in the same way that any form of art has that license, and even forms of art that are dealing with historical subjects or are dealing with nonfiction. What I take away from history is that it is very much concerned with truth, both in the capital T sense and also sort of in the smaller sense, in the sense of facts and sense of accuracy and the sense of what we know and what we can show and what we can prove.
Yeah, and by definition, Jamel, that would be complexity. That is, there are a whole bunch of stories going on at any given moment. We recognize that to isolate one event out of a flow of events is, by definition, to distort that event.
Right. And you know, to a big extent, what film does is the exact opposite. What the best movies mm-hmm. do, in fact, is flatten out and simplify and give you a single narrative strand that does come at the expense of other perspectives. I think if a filmmaker has a responsibility, it's to be as capital T truthful to the experiences of the people that the filmmaker is trying to capture. So in the case of Selma, I think the question, if you're going to kind of pass judgment on the movie as a movie, is does this reflect the experiences of the people involved in the civil rights movement?
So there is a check on her vision, and that is she needs to be true to the participants in the movement.
Right.
It's not that she's entitled to tell us anything she wants.
Right.
She needs to be true to something, to the people who matter.
Right. And even this, I mean, there are even limits to this. And so right now, on February 8th, it was the 100th anniversary of Birth of a Nation, kind of the arguably one of the greatest films ever made in the United States. It is a landmark of film. It's also
It's an awful movie.
It's deeply noxious. It's so socially irresponsible that we're still feeling the impact of it 100 years later.
Yeah. But it was a film with a civic mission. It seems awful and horrendous to us today. That seems to me to signal a latent possible danger in trying to tell those higher moral truths, and that is they change from generation to generation.
That's absolutely right. In 1915, most Americans would have and did understand Birth of a Nation as getting to something true about the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that that was wrong now. And I'm not sure how one, you know, precludes that.
Jamel, it's been great talking about history, art, the movie business, particularly at this time of year. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Jamel Bowie is a staff writer at Slate. We'll post a link to his piece about Selma at backstoryradio.org.
We're going to take a short break now. When we get back, we'll give Selma the backstory treatment and debate the merits of Selma's depiction of history.
You're listening to Backstory. We'll be right back.
We're back with Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Brian Ballow.
And I'm Ed Ayers. Today on the show, we're celebrating Oscars weekend with our own version of an award show. We're considering the ways that history has been depicted in film and other popular media this past year.
Before the break, we were discussing what's probably this year's biggest instance of history versus Hollywood. That's the Oscar-nominated movie, Selma. Slate contributor Jamel Bowie was making the case that we should overlook its cartoonish depiction of LBJ because as a message film, Selma is serving a larger, capital T, truth. And I'm just wondering, you guys have both seen this movie. What do you make of that argument that director Ava DuVernay's commitment to depicting the civil rights movement justifies the artistic license she takes with what actually happened in the White House?
Well, Peter, I don't care if there is an injunction. I'm in the street marching against this movie.
Right.
And the funny thing is, I agree with Jamel that we really need to ask what the filmmaker is trying to do. And DuVernay has been very eloquent in interviews after the movie saying she wanted to make a film about the people who make up the movement. The problem is she doesn't do that. The problem is she is so intent on displacing the trope of the great white savior in the form of Johnson, that she replaces him with the great black savior, Martin Luther King. And, you know, at the very time, and you can see hints of this in the movie, but at the very time that Selma was happening, that was one of the fundamental African-American criticisms of King. He was the great man who would sweep in for those photo opportunities to get on the front pages of the Times. And as you can see in the film, that is part of his strategy. All I'm saying is that for somebody who wants to make a film about the people, there were precious few scenes with the actual people in the film.
Well, Brian, let me interject here. She has to dramatize this moment, right? She has to give us people we can identify with. She has the challenge of giving us the grand sweep of history in intimate detail. That's an artistic challenge for her, how to render that.
But Peter, you and Ed both know that one could provide the grand sweep of history by staying out of the Oval Office.
Yeah, maybe that's not a grand sweeping place. Yeah.
By keeping the camera in place after that really tough opening with the bombing of the Birmingham church, which happened in 1963, by keeping the camera there and looking at the rioting that followed, this was a violation of King's fundamental philosophy. This was the kind of frustration that was beginning to break out into violence on the streets, continued in 1964 in Rochester and in New York City.
Well, Brian, let me defend DuVernay here a little bit and suggest you're moving toward a documentary. And why not do this with authentic newsreels and get the language right and get everything right? I think she's trying to give us individuals who represent factions in the movement. The generational struggle is depicted, but it's all reduced to individuals. And in some ways, they are less satisfying than I think we want them to be because they stand in for factions and groups, because violence is personified somewhat mysteriously by Malcolm X because we don't really understand him in the movie. But this is the artistic choice she makes, is to make it a study in characters who are larger than life because they represent more than their individual lives.
And I think, Brian and Peter, this is what the movie's really about. She's trying to explain how did American history move. And in my understanding of it, she's trying to show that it's moving out of three fundamental vectors. One is exactly the great man of Martin Luther King and the power that he exerts over the media. He's very much aware that in some ways he doesn't deserve it. You know, that's what the Nobel Peace Prize thing at the beginning is. He doesn't know how to dress for this role on the world stage, right? But he takes it as a burden that has fallen to him. That's his responsibility. Then she tries to portray the movement as a kind of pastiche, Brian, and I think this is what you find so frustrating, is that she just has little tiny pieces of people who are investing their entire lives in this movement. We see them just for a moment, whether it's the character played by Oprah Winfrey very valiantly and in a very solitary way, trying to register before a racist court clerk, or whether it's a young white minister who comes from the North only to be beaten to death, or whether it's the dramas inside families as they're trying to figure out how much of themselves do they put at risk. And then the other part of the story, the older story that people believe for a long time, that this was basically Kennedy and then Johnson moving history right along the way. So I think what the movie's about is the intersection, the stress, the pull among those three vectors that are moving history.
Ed, I think that's really well put, and I do think you've distilled my criticism of the movie, if not the criticism of the movie, and right, and that is the balance is all wrong. If somebody wants to make a film about the people in the movement, you can't have the people in the movement for 12 minutes and Martin Luther King for an hour and a half,
yeah,
with a half an hour of Johnson looking more like the evil J. Edgar Hoover as the last third, as you put it.
And I think that we have the same problem with this movie that we have about many movies about American history, including Lincoln. We just don't seem to have the confidence to actually make a movie about American people making their own
right
history.
So have we ever made a movie like that, Ed?
You know, the closest one that comes to my mind is the movie Glory.
Yeah.
You do have Matthew Broderick playing a very unpersuasive Robert Gould Shaw, but the stars of that movie are the black soldiers themselves who are trying to figure out, is this nation worth giving its life for?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it's a movie that dares not have heroes and dares to have all its heroes killed and thrown into a mass grave on the beach of South Carolina. I think that if we have the courage to actually look the loss, the sacrifice, the breadth of commitment in the face, we could do more satisfying art.
Well, Peter and Ed, let's link arms and march together on behalf of films that will never be made by Hollywood. If you're just joining us, this is Backstory. And we're talking today about the way history was depicted in last year's popular media. We're going to turn now to television, where espionage seemed to be all the rage in 2014. AMC debuted a show called Turn, about Revolutionary War-era spies. ABC countered with the miniseries Assets, about a disgraced CIA officer who sells secrets to the Soviets. But no spy show has captured as much attention as FX's mega hit, The Americans, which entered its second season to rave reviews.
Set in the Cold War 80s, The Americans follows the hidden lives of a seemingly average couple in suburban D.C., Elizabeth and Philip Jennings. They're actually Soviet spies working under deep cover to steal state secrets, poison U.S. officials, and plant bugs all over the place. But their co-workers, their friends, even their own children don't know the truth. In counterintelligence lingo, these kinds of spies were known as illegals. And in exactly the period depicted in The Americans, a real person named David Major was briefing President Reagan on the FBI's efforts to uncover illegals. So we invited David to tell us more about who these illegals were and how he went about catching them. David, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
So what is an illegal, and how's that different from a legal spy?
Any espionage case can be broken down into two parts. One part is the collector, he's the one or she's the one who are in the position to be there to collect information from a betrayer. A betrayer is usually somebody who has access to secrets, somebody who's in the government, as somebody who has a security clearance, and they have to pass that information to an intermediary to get back to, for example, Russia.
Right.
And so the Russians were very good at having what we call legal establishments. Could be an embassy, could be trade office. And buried within those organizations were diplomats who were, in fact, undercover KGB officers or staff officers for the KGB. Now, in addition to that, they have this thing called illegals, and that's somebody like the show, deep cover, if you would. They're not protected diplomatically. They represent a very great challenge to someone like myself because it could be anybody at any time. And like they show you in the TV series, there really were illegals. I worked cases just like the ones that are in the TV show.
So tell me this. How many illegals would there have been in the United States when you were advising the president?
There always have been a small number. In fact, it's important to note that when the Soviet Union was established in 1917, the first thing they did is they created the Cheka, which was their internal intelligence service. But by 1919, they established a worldwide, or starting of a worldwide espionage network directed against the West. The GRU, Soviet Military Intelligence, in 1924 sent to the United States the first illegals. So there is a history within the Soviet Union of using illegals and using them very successfully.
One thing the Americans depicts is the emotional stress that illegals have to go through since they've given their entire lives to the governments they're working for. And I want to play you a tape from one scene in their second season when the main characters find out they don't have control over their children's lives either. So let's play the clip here.
They want Paige to be next.
That is not an option.
Those are your orders. First, soon, you need to tell her who you really are, who she really is. Get her ready. Then develop her until the time is right for you to tell her that she will join our ranks.
There's a number of examples where that kind of a thing did happen, where the person became a teenager and they said, now it's time to recruit him. One of them is a case in New Jersey, in New York, in which the son got to be 17 and they said, the time has come that he has to be trained. And they sent him to Moscow to start his espionage career while he was still in high school. And I worked that case. From that standpoint, that's realistic. And what it does is it gives you this great long-term, very obscure, secret collection capability. But it does take a lot of commitment by any service to do that.
This seems like a lot of trouble for the Soviets to go to implant these people in American society so deeply. What could they do that other kinds of spies couldn't?
The first thing to realize about illegals is they were established that if you broke relations with the country, they still had a collection capability because they figured that the intelligence officers out of the embassies would be kicked out of the country, which they probably would. And in the beginning of the Soviet Union, they had no diplomatic presence. So it gave them a capability to have a collection capability that would exist. It also is used for some of the very, very best sources that you would have. If you had a very good source that you really had to protect them, knowing that their legal officers were identified by the FBI and that it was a matter of making contact with your agent and not let us see it, another way of handling some of the best sources would be illegals. So you could take a person who shouldn't be known to the FBI at all. So the secrets is in their anonymity.
I see.
So that's why you spend the time and the effort to build mm-hmm. this collection capability. We do the same thing around the world in the CIA with a few modifications. For example, in the illegals and the Russians, one of the things they do is when they deploy someone in one of these missions, they may do it for their entire life. And
right.
That's real commitment. Americans don't do that. We may have someone committed for 10, 15 years, but not their entire life.
So how would you catch such people? I mean, that sounds, if they're embedded for a lifetime, it sounds as if they could be hard to catch.
They can be very difficult to catch. And usually it's done because somebody on the inside of, for example, the Soviet Intelligence Service gives you a hint. And then investigation can identify them. In today's modern Russia, the new normal is the resurfacing of illegals, just like the show. There have been a number of illegals that have been arrested in the recent past. For example, there was a couple in Canada. They're arrested in like 1996. There was a man who was arrested in, I think it was 2007. He was in Canada also. There was another couple that are arrested in Germany in 2000, I think it was 11, and they had been there for 20 years. And then just 2 weeks ago, there is another illegal that is arrested up in New York who was a banker.
So I guess I've been assuming as a devoted follower of the Americans from the outset that when the Soviet Union falls, that these people are going to be gone. But what you're suggesting is that we might expect that this could have multiple seasons ahead as they convert into away from Soviets and into Russians. Is that possible?
Not only did they not fall, in some cases that we're uncovering today, we've actually had cases of people who were in place when the Soviet Union collapsed, who are here in the United States, and just continued to be illegals, to run operations, despite the fact that the Soviet Union, as we knew it, went away. But their intelligence services never went away. They just changed the name of the service. And it is true, if you look back in history, oh, that person was here when the Soviet Union collapsed in 91. I wonder how that felt for them when their country went away, but their espionage never did. So yes, the Americans does not have to go away with the collapse of the Soviet Union, because in real life, it continued to operate, and it continues to operate to this very day.
You heard it here first, folks. The Americans may have many years ahead of it. David, thanks so much for explaining all this to us today. We really appreciate it.
I hope I made it clear enough.
That's David Major, a former counterintelligence and security advisor for President Ronald Reagan. Today, he heads the Center for Counterintelligence and Security Studies in Falls Church, Virginia.
This is Backstory. I'm Brian Ballow.
I'm Peter Ronoff.
And I'm Ed Ayers. Today on the show, it's our annual Academy Awards edition of Backstory. This year, we're not just focusing on movies. We're looking at the way American history was depicted in a number of different popular media last year.
We spent a lot of time today looking at pop culture from last year. But time marches on, even on Backstory. And it happens that our producer, Emily Gaddick, was just at the Sundance Film Festival.
Hey, that's not fair.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, she's here with us now in the studio, and she's going to tell us about some of the films that tackle American history in the coming year.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Emily, welcome back.
Oh, it's good to be here. I actually have a gift for each of you from Sundance. Three films, one from each of your periods that I think you'll find really interesting. So we'll start with one of the most talked about films actually at Sundance from Peter's period, The Witch. Can you guess what it would be about?
Existentialism.
Oh, brooms, yeah. Well, let me guess. Salem.
It is about a Puritan community in New England a few decades before Salem, actually. And without giving too much away, because it is kind of a suspenseful horror movie, basically a young child in the community goes missing, and as people try and figure out what happens, more and more the suspicion shifts to witchcraft being involved in the incident. But what people are actually really talking about with the movie is the incredible attention to period detail and language. And a lot is being said about the sets that were created using period tools. So no iron nails were used in creating these farmhouses, because that would have been inaccurate. The characters don't have forks, because spoons and knives would have really been what they eat with. And all the costumes were sewn, hand-sewn with period cloth.
Unfortunately, they used period cameras, so there's actually nothing to see.
Right.
Yes, there's just a candle on stage, just darkness. So that's one that's been getting a lot of attention, and that should be released not only in theaters, but also video on demand sometime this year, although there's no release date yet, but you should watch out for it.
Okay, right, I'll look for it.
What else you got, Emily?
Well, Ed, don't feel left out, because we have something from the 19th century.
Of course.
Another award winner called Slow West.
Uh-huh.
It is another movie where the plot is not necessarily what people are excited about. It's more like the mood and kind of the feel of the movie.
It's slow.
The title might have given it away. But basically the plot is there's a young Scott who's in love with a girl named Rose. He heads to America to try and find her again. He hooks up with a bounty hunter played by Michael Fassbender. But what he doesn't know is there's a bounty on the head of his beloved. And there you go. But it's been described as a psychedelic Western. It's got kind of...
Wear your tie-dye.
Yeah.
So it's a period Western, just the wrong period, right?
Yeah, 1960s.
Just the wrong period. But another kind of a movie where people are really into the mood of it. The plot is apparently a little bit loose, but something else to look forward to that should, just like The Witch, be out both on video on demand, so you can watch it right in your home, or also in theaters sometime later this year. No release date yet.
Okay. Well, too bad they left out the 20th century.
Yeah, but who needs it? We live in... No, it isn't the 20th century anymore.
You live in it, Peter.
Well, never fear, Brian, because I have something for you as well. Sundance is also famous for its documentary section. And this year at the festival, there was a screening of a movie about the Black Panthers called Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution.
Cool.
Basically, it chronicles the rise and fall of the Black Panther Party. Lots of great footage from the time. Interviews with surviving party members, including Kathleen Cleaver, famously married to Eldridge. And also lots of interviews with former police officers in Oakland and L.A. who tangled with the Panthers.
That sounds like a terrific documentary.
Yeah, and that will actually be out in limited release this fall in theaters, and you'll also be able to see it on PBS in early 2016.
So, Brian, maybe you'll finally be satisfied with the portrayal of the movement now.
My kind of film, and there'll be at least 17 people who go to see it.
Hey, thanks for the report from the front lines.
Thank you, Emily.
Oh, my pleasure.
Emily Gaddick is one of our producers. If you have other suggestions on what we should be watching in the coming year, tweet them at us. We're at Backstory Radio.
In between devouring episodes of Backstory last year, you might have caught an episode, or 12, of a little podcast called Serial. In a dozen episodes released weekly, veteran This American Life producer Sarah Koenig investigated a single crime, the 1999 murder of a Baltimore high school student named Haemin Lee. Lee's ex-boyfriend, Adnan Syed, was found guilty in her killing and has spent 15 years in prison. Koenig's reporting was driven by a simple question. Did Adnan really do it?
Serial topped the podcast charts for months and garnered more than 68 million downloads, leading us to decide that it qualified as a popular depiction of history for the purposes of today's show. If you're not familiar with it, let's just say this podcast became a cultural phenomenon, spawning its own thread on Reddit and even podcasts about the podcast. Scores of articles and blog posts debated the ins and outs of Adnan's case, pondered Serial's portrayal of race and gender, and questioned whether Koenig was doing old-fashioned investigative reporting or just taking advantage of a tragedy to tell a gripping story. In a November piece in The Atlantic titled, Is It Wrong to Be Hooked on Serial?, Adrienne LaFrance took up the question of Serial's journalistic ethics. She joins me now to tell us what she decided. Adrienne, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you write that serialized nonfiction as a storytelling format has a long history of its own, that Serial, the podcast, wasn't really groundbreaking journalism in that way.
Right. So we may be accustomed to listening to radio in more sort of complete chunks today, like a story has a beginning and an end, and at the end of an hour, the story is over. But as you mentioned, serialized storytelling goes way back, goes back centuries, in fact. There's this long history of serialized novels that gave rise to a more recent history of serialized news. We mostly think of the Victorian age as sort of the golden era of serialization. That's where we had stories like Charles Dickens' The Pickwick Papers and Flaubert's Madame Bovary, both of which were serialized. And then that continued in the 20th century with works, very well-known works, critically acclaimed works like In Cold Blood, which was serialized when it first came out.
So what's new about Serial? I gather that people are critical of the fact that these very real-life figures, some who are no longer alive, one who's imprisoned right now, are not fictional characters. But it seems like you're saying there is a kind of long history of serializing nonfiction.
Right. And I thought about this a lot when Serial first came out because it was so compelling. And I found myself waiting week to week for the episode to come out and sort of like being excited for Thursday morning, which is when the new episodes would be downloaded. And I started to feel sort of icky about this and wondering, you know, I'm looking forward to this the way I might look forward to an episode of Mad Men. And I felt like as a listener, I was a little bit able to disassociate the compelling storyline from the real tragedy of it. Upon closer reflection, you know, one has to acknowledge that that's what great journalism often does. You know, the breadth of human experience involves a lot of tragedy, and great storytellers explain what happens. And just because it's compelling doesn't mean it's bad.
Yeah, I suppose I simply don't get this because I'm an historian and a lot of history is tragic. And I've never felt icky reading a compelling account of slavery or reading a compelling account of the Holocaust, where arguably far greater harm and damage
was done than even the tragedy of this story in Serial. Is it because it's so intimate, so personal?
It may be that. I think also some people have pointed out that some of the production elements around the podcast, for instance, there is a theme song. So that's something that might come off to some as sort of lighthearted or just some of the things that make it seem entertaining or akin to the format of a show that's purely for entertainment. And this fan community sort of sprang up around the podcast in the same way that you might see fans gather around a show like Mad Men or Lost. And yet Serial is a real story about real people and a tragedy.
But aren't these fan clubs, I don't mean everybody, but couldn't there be a positive contribution here socially, i.e. people coming up with evidence, people seeing things from angles that they hadn't seen before? I mean, isn't this really how history is written?
Right. I agree with you. And I think that's a very sort of internet era approach to reporting in that, you know, we've seen with the decline of print newspapers, for instance, a move away from this sort of authoritative news voice of, you know, I am the journalist, I am an expert, I can tell you what happened, there's no sense of doubt, whatever else, to a place where we're all reporting in real time. We're often figuring things out in front of an audience rather than just publishing a story and moving on. It's a level of ongoing engagement with readers. And as for the participation of listeners, people who are posting theories on fan boards or writing their own articles or involved in subreddits, the reality of publishing today is that anyone can publish at any time to the internet, usually from a smartphone in their pocket. And to me, that's one of the truly great advancements in modern human history. So it's something that we're getting used to, the democratization of publishing. But ultimately, I think it's a great thing.
Adrian LaFrance is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. We'll link to her article about Serial from our site, backstoryradio.org.
If you're just joining us, this is Backstory. In this hour, we've been weighing the merits of a range of popular media that took on American history last year. We've considered a video game, a film, a TV show, and a podcast. We're going to wrap things up with a look at a more familiar medium for history, books.
So I have here a list of the best-selling history titles from this past year. At the top, Glenn Beck's Dreamers and Deceivers, true stories of the heroes and villains who made America, with more than 100,000 copies sold. Right behind are Fox News personalities Brian Kilmeade with George Washington's Secret Six, and Bill O'Reilly, who has two books on the list, Killing Kennedy and Killing Lincoln. There is one book from the other side of the political spectrum, The People's History of the United States by left-leaning political scientist Howard Zinn, first published 35 years ago and still selling in the 50,000 range. And there are also a bunch of writers on the list with no obvious political leanings, journalists like Bill Bryson, Eric Larson, and Hampton Sides, as well as the well-known biographer and former PBS commentator Doris Kearns Goodwin. In January, high school history teacher and Civil War scholar Kevin Levin reflected on this list on his blog, Civil War Memory. Kevin pointed out that most of the books were written by journalists and by men. But when I sat down with Kevin, he told me that the books share another important trait.
They tell very good stories. I think that's what it comes down to. And I think in the end, you know, that's what people want. I mean, I think that's what I want when I'm, you know, when I'm looking for a, you know, an entertaining book of history. I want a fast-moving story. I want stories about interesting people. And I want to be able, by the end of it, to make some connections with my own life. I want to be able to draw some kind of meaning from those stories. And I think they deliver on that.
You know, I think that's right. I think you used the word when I want an entertaining book of history. And yeah. I think all of these books are set out explicitly in one way or another, even Zen, to be entertaining rather than strictly instructive. Does that seem a fair thing to say?
That's right. And even when I'm in the classroom, I mean, as much as I want my students, when I'm teaching either the AP or my non-AP survey, I want them to think about social, political history. But I know that what's going to sort of function as the hook that's going to get them going is a good tale.
Kevin, there's a very large elephant standing in the corner of the room here that I feel like I'm going to have to acknowledge, which is that none of these books are written by academic historians, people who make their living doing this. You know, and so should we despair, or should we just realize this is the market doing what the market does, or are we really screwing up in some way? What's your advice? I know that you're a published author. I know that you have an advanced degree in history yourself as well as a teacher. So you're in an interesting position to be able to see the whole landscape, unlike me, who just notices that I'm not on this list.
Well, look, I think it's easy to just sort of dismiss the whole thing, the list, and, you know, there are no academics on this, and, you know, what do we have to say about that? I think this is first the top end of the list, and I think, you know, if we were to go down a little bit further into sales, I think we would find some, you know, academic historians. And I think if historians want to make more inroads into these kinds of audiences, I think they do have to begin to consider the use of, you know, things like social media, Facebook, Twitter, blogging. I mean, that's sort of what I've tried to do over the last 10 years is build an audience. And, you know, you look at, there are academics, Niall Ferguson, Juan Cole, Henry Louis Gates, Simon Shama. They all have a social media presence, and they're all involved, obviously, in publishing books, but they do a lot of other things as well. And so I think those types of academics are probably enjoying more success than those historians who are resisting the urge.
So is this something new? Was there a time when academic historians were popular and beloved?
You know,
tell me there was, Kevin.
I wish I could say for certain. I mean, I think one thing we should be just sensitive to is the fact that, you know, what academics consider to be sort of to count as history and historical explanation is relatively new. I mean, as I understand it, you know, it's the end of the 19th, early 20th century, this sort of idea of objective history. And yet, you know, people have been writing about history going back to the ancient Greeks. And I think it's unfortunate to me that academic historians, because of the priorities, because of the agenda within the academy, it's almost as if they are, you know, leaving at times, at important times, leaving the history to people who are wholly unprepared to talk about it.
So my takeaway so far is that you think historians, it's our own damn fault that we're not reaching this audience, that there's clearly people who are interested in the past. There are people interested in how we got here. You know, it's interesting what you're pointing out is that what we think of as history is actually a relatively recent phenomenon. And we don't want to accept that this is the real form of history and all these other things are just diluted or watered down versions of it. So, you know, as a blogger, and you were saying that, you know, that you pretty much need to be multi-platform these days if you're going to sell a lot. And there's no doubt that people hear about Bill O'Reilly or Glenn Beck from seeing them on television and a lot of cross-marketing. Do you think that the nature of writing history will change as we look for history in formats other than hardback books?
I do, and I think the big game changer for me, and I think this is sort of something that a lot of people have trouble with, and definitely academics specifically, I think the internet basically has made the idea of a gatekeeper, you know, I think it's torn that idea apart. I think for good and for bad, right, you punch something into Google, you read the first link that pops up. So there's very little assessment going on, and so I think there's a great danger in that, but there's also great promise. One of the things that I've found fascinating as a blogger is just the number of people I've come to meet and the ideas that I've benefited from. There are a lot of really smart people out there, and I certainly don't want to consider, you know, their feedback to be a form of, you know, peer review in the strictest sense. But man, what I do is much better because of it. At least for me, there's always been an important social element to doing history. We don't want to be locked in a room just looking at the archives and writing things. I mean, we want to be engaged with people. We want to be sharing ideas. I mean, that's, to me, what it's all about.
Kevin Levin is a high school history teacher in Waltham, Massachusetts, and he blogs at CivilWarMemory.com. He published a book of his own a couple of years ago, Remembering the Battle of the Crater, War as Murder.
That's going to do it for us today.
but we'd love to know about your favorite media depictions of history from last year. Leave us a comment at backstoryradio.org or share it with us via email. Our address is backstory@virginia.edu. We tweet at Backstory Radio. Whatever you do, don't be a stranger. But to me it seems quite clear that it's
all just a little bit of history repeating. Today's episode of Backstory was produced by Tony Field, Nina Ernest, Andrew Parsons, Kelly Jones, Emily Gaddick, and Robert Armengol. And Jamal Milner is our engineer. We had help from Coley Elhai. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major support for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional funding is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, humanities, and the environment, and by History Channel, history made every day.
Brian Ballow is professor of history at the University of Virginia. Peter Onuf is professor of history emeritus at UVA and senior research fellow at Monticello. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.
Backstory is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.